Welcome to Health and Human Science Matters, a podcast by Colorado State University's College of Health and Human Sciences. I'm Avery Martin, co-host and Assistant Director of Communications.
And I'm Matt Hickey, Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Studies. In our college, we make it our mission to optimize human health and well-being through discovery and innovation. But don't just take our word for it. Each episode, we sit down with people who fulfill that mission, our college faculty and staff.
And on some occasions, we get very special guests outside of the college. So today, we're sitting down with Dr. Marion Underwood, Colorado State University's Provost and Executive Vice President. Marion, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We are really delighted to get some time. We know how busy you are, and we've been looking forward to this. So thank you so much for coming over and joining us for a little bit.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we, of course, are a land grant. Our podcast has typically been rooted in a research mission, of course, but I would love your sense of opportunities and challenges, two sides to a coin, I think, for CSU in terms of all three parts of our mission. So our teaching, our research, and our really neat opportunities for engagement as well.
This will sound like I'm not answering your question, but I hope I get to it. I see CSU as a place with so many exciting things happening and so many distinctive features that are not yet appreciated by people in the outside world. I see CSU as having just incredible accomplishments already and tremendous potential. And I would love to see, I'd love to work with the faculty and the staff to craft a more distinctive mission for the university that really highlights what is special. I think, you know, as universities face the headwinds of enrollment cliffs and even people questioning, like, what's the value of a four-year degree? What are you really doing? You know, why is it worth all this money? I think every university has to have a very distinctive mission that everyone on the campus understands and that might make more people in the rest of the country want to choose CSU for their education. So, you know, to me, the distinctive efforts here, the really big themes that to me stand out that make CSU distinctive have to do with, one is climate and sustainability, which I think of as very broadly. I think the College of Health and Human Sciences has a lot to say about climate and sustainability. One Health, the idea that health is not just about humans, it's about animal health, it's about the food supply, it's about climate and sustainability, and democracy. As part of the Democracy Initiative, there are courses offered all across the university. There's courses in engineering and computer science related to the Democracy Initiative. So I'm not sure the rest of the world understands that CSU is really doing some really special interdisciplinary things in those three spaces. Yeah. And I would like to make that a lot more clear. And I think it could start with our institutional learning objectives, which, you know, like most universities, are kind of general. And the faculty council is really interested in taking a look at those to help those change to highlight some of our distinctive themes. And then I'd like to work with the faculty on innovation in the undergraduate core curriculum so that students know they can come here and study, maybe take all their undergraduate core courses along a theme of One Health or climate and sustainability or democracy or other themes the faculty might come up with because the curriculum belongs to the faculty. Mm-hmm. On the research side, I think we should be doing big interdisciplinary projects in whatever our distinctive areas are going to be. And sure, those three I named are from the academic master plan, but the faculty may come up with others. One faculty member made a great suggestion that another theme could be Colorado. Like, what if you could take all of your undergraduate core curriculum courses on Colorado? There are probably people all across the country who are fascinated by Colorado.
Absolutely.
That's a way to demonstrate our value to the state.
Here, here.
So we should have big interdisciplinary teams working in these areas. And I think a lot of that's happening already. We need to elevate what we've got. We've got so much going on in climate and sustainability. Yeah. It's hard to know where all of it is. And, right, and I think it makes it less visible to the external world that we have so many different kind of structures and entities. And then in our extension and outreach, I think we can do, you know, so much to take what we know about these areas to help the state understand what we're doing, help Fort Collins understand what we're doing, help the nation understand what we're doing. So some of it's about new effort, but some of it is about elevating what's already happening here and making it part of our mission, making it part of our curriculum, making it an emphasis in our research and highlighting it in all of our extension and engagement opportunities. CSU has a lot of interesting assets. You know, the Spur campus.
Yes.
Yeah, what a world of opportunity that is. And there's amazing things happening there already, but so much more could be possible. Our president's really interested in having a first year program at Spur so that students who live in Denver don't feel ready to move to Fort Collins could start and do their first year at the Spur campus.
Oh, that'd be incredible.
It's a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And what if we had, you know, certificates, minors, academic offerings at Spur that could serve the workforce needs of industry partners in Denver? Mm. What if we had an admissions and enrollment presence at Spur where a person who had to leave college because they didn't have the money to continue could stop by and say, hey, I have this many credits. How many would transfer? Can I come? Like, how could I? Do you have anything online? We could have, you know, a presence at Spur for all kinds of people in Denver. So
I love this.
That is
this is why
so
these
awesome.
Conversations are so fun, right?
Love it.
Now, you understand the role of a faculty member. You, of course, a very active researcher yourself, and you've worked your way into administration. And we want to hear about your journey. How did you get started? And this can be people, mentors, family members, moments where, aha, I think I want to do this graduate school thing.
Yeah.
Tell us your story.
Well, I had one of my earliest academic mentors was actually my high school boyfriend's mother, a woman named Beth Unger at Kansas State University, who earned her PhD in computer science. Her undergraduate education was in mechanical engineering.
Wow.
And so by being at his house a lot in my senior year in high school, I got to kind of see her life up close and see how she worked and how she managed things with her family. And she's remained a really good friend of mine, although my relationship with her son ended when we were in college. She's been a mentor and has been very encouraging of me in different roles and has had wonderful advice. I mean, I remember when we had our second child and I happened to see her at Christmas time or something. And she said, you know, just make sure that you get a few minutes a day with each child one-on-one, no matter what. Even if you just go sit on the floor of their bedroom, they'll talk to you eventually. You
know?
No matter how busy your work life gets. And then when I moved into the graduate dean role at University of Texas at Dallas, she said, you know, in every position I've ever had, I got the most done in my first 1 to 2 years. So don't think you just have to do nothing but listen, you know, listen, but look for opportunities because people give you grace. And so she retired as a vice provost of technology and continuing education. She was really ahead of her time in understanding the potential power of online education and the importance of using technology to make learning better.
Sure.
You know? So she had a number of administrative roles. And so that was really important advice. And she's always had good advice for me and we've stayed in touch. And then as an undergraduate student, I thought I would major in chemistry. I thought I wanted to be a doctor and loved chemistry in high school. And then I took a psychology class and I realized I could study what I thought about all the time anyway. You know, what I was naturally curious about could be my major. And I remember calling to tell my parents, so excited. My father was a professor of geology and my mother had worked in human resources, but made our family her career. And I remember telling my dad, I'm going to major in psychology. And he said, what in the world will you do with that? And I said, I'll be a university professor. And he couldn't argue because he was a professor of geology and showed me how much he loved, you know, his academic work. I was a junior psychology major when a faculty member invited me to do research in his lab in the summer. I was in his research methods class. And he said, you know, you seem pretty good at this. Would you want to work in my lab this summer? And I said, well, what would I do? Oh, don't worry. I'll teach you. And I remember being nervous. I remember walking into that building in the summer thinking, what am I going to do? But he made it so fun. And he showed me how just incredible it could be to think up questions and come up with ways to answer them and look at data and analyze it. And he really changed my life. His name is Jonathan Cheek. He is still a faculty member, although he seemed quite old to me at the time. He was not at all. He was an assistant professor. And so he, you know, he's still on the faculty at Wellesley and been a lifelong mentor and friend. And then I went from there to Duke University and had a wonderful research mentor in John Cooey, who was my PhD advisor and my mentor there the whole time. And still, again, a friend, a wonderful mentor, and modeled for me how you can have, you know, very high standards, but also be kind and positive and see the best in people. And he was just tremendous. He was so generous and gave me so many opportunities. And, you know, I had wonderful mentors at Reed College, teaching mentors, research mentors. And then I went to the University of Texas at Dallas to work in a school of behavioral and brain sciences led by just an outstanding dean named Bert Moore, who was really special. I mean, just a phenomenal academic leader. And everybody called him the dean of deans. He was dean for over 20 years.
And
so strategic, so warm. You would interact with him briefly and feel affirmed, supported, and have three ideas how to be better. He was just masterful. And so I actually took that job. I had met him at a small research conference, and I took that job because I wanted to work with him.
Sure. Yeah.
And I got to work very closely with him. I was at UT Dallas for 20 years. I worked with him closely for 17. He passed away from pancreatic cancer 17 years into my time there. But he's been such an important mentor. So I've had a life rich with mentors.
Counts your blessings. Like, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. But I got into, you know, I was a very happy faculty member at UT Dallas. And from the time I showed up, I was getting asked to lead in large ways by the provost, who I got to know early, another excellent provost, Hobson Wildenthal. And he would ask me to do things like, you know, lead a center for teaching and learning and be in charge of online education. And I would say, I don't know anything about online education. And so I said, no. And he told me at one point, he said, you will say yes to me one day. And I said, oh, yeah, why? And he said, you will be tired of having administration done to you.
Oh.
But I never got there because I had this amazing dean, a phenomenal dean, just world-class dean. So yeah. I learned a lot from that dean and then ended up in an associate dean role, then was approached about the graduate dean position. And again, that didn't make any sense to me because I'd been very focused on undergraduate education, although loved, you know, working with grad students.
Sure.
But both Bert and my dean and my provost said, this is great. You would love this. And I did. It was such a great opportunity to work across the whole university to, you know, support graduate education. Because if you can elevate graduate education, you make everything better. It lets you attract and retain even better faculty members. It raises the quality of the undergraduate program. And, you know, it's an opportunity to educate the next generation of thought leaders, possibly academics. And graduate students are flexible and open to trying new things. And so that was a wonderful role. And I had a chance to build a team. And there were over 9,000 graduate students at UT Dallas when I took that role, about a third of the university's enrollment. So that was just great. I loved that job. That was in 2015. And then in 2017, I was asked to apply for the role at Purdue. I thought, well, okay. I didn't think it would come to anything, but did a web interview, visited as a campus finalist. And I was so taken with the people and wanted to join that university because of a phenomenal provost named Jay Ackridge, but also the great team in the College of Health and Human Sciences. And I loved the idea of a college devoted to human health and well-being. And like this college, that college had really diverse units, everything from nursing to hospitality to a lot of bench science. It was a fantastic role. I loved getting to think across those diverse disciplines and the challenge of bringing them together and the challenge of helping a university so focused on STEM see how important it is to elevate human health and quality of life. And the College of Health and Human Sciences at Purdue was the third largest undergraduate college there. And you would never know it, you know, by their branding or anything else. But it was such a fun challenge to advocate for that large group of students and for the excellence of our programs. And as I was dean there, I saw when Lisa Youngblade was appointed here, and I'm like, oh, she used to teach at UT Dallas before I did. And I saw how she started to kind of bring this college together and the branding she was doing. I'm like, look at that. That's pretty cool. You know, so I was following this College of Health and Human Sciences as I was the dean of that one.
Wow. We were doing the same for you.
Well, I mean, the colleges are not that dissimilar. I mean, the units aren't identical.
Absolutely.
Construction management is something really special that you all have here.
Yes.
And I love how Lisa and all of you have made that part of health and human health and quality of life. How can it not be?
Right.
You know?
So tell us about your scholarly interests, themes you pursued as a scholar over the course of your career.
You know, the truth is I've always been fascinated by bad behavior. So I was, as a child, I was very conscientious, would never step out of line, you know, always tried to do everything right. Certainly not perfect, but I really wanted to behave and be good. But because I would finish my work kind of quickly early on, my teachers would give me the opportunity to interact with students who were maybe on the other end of that spectrum, not afraid to break the rules.
Right.
And they were struggling academically. So I would, you know, finish my math and say, okay, go help him with his. You know? And
so, you're a TA early on.
Yeah, so I got to know. I got to know these kids who were really different than I was in their willingness to push the boundaries and break the rules. And I was always kind of fascinated by it, like, I knew it wasn't good. It didn't work out that well for them, but it takes a kind of a courage, you know, and working with them on academics, I could see like the good qualities that they had, like this person has a lot of really good things on their side. And so, you know, when I started to study psychology and was applying to graduate school, my interests were really broad. I mean, my essays, I look at them, I still have found them the other, when I was moving the last time.
Yeah. Nice.
I said that my research interests were how relationships contributed to adjustment. That was my, and I thought that was very focused and specific. Of course, all different kinds of people thought that was a good match for what they did. But sure. I went to work with John Cooey, who was doing work on the prevention of aggression and violence, and really admired his work and his approach. But in my initial interview with him, it was 30 minutes and I thought it was done. And then he handed me some articles and he said, come back and talk to me later. And I was young enough. I thought that was a bad sign. You know, I thought that wasn't good, but he was giving me more time. So I read his articles and they were all about boys. So I went back later and I said, well, this is important. And, you know, yeah, kids hate each other, but what about girls? Girls can be mean in ways that really hurt. And would you ever study that? And he said, well, if you come here, I'll work with girls. I'll study that. Nice. You know, so he gave me the opportunity.
That's really cool.
And so I'm always been interested in how people handle anger and aggression. And, you know, because we all want what we want, yes. but we also want relationships. And that's I think Freud said that, right? Mm-hmm. That there's some like this fundamental tension between we have our own agenda, we want our own goals, but we want to be connected with people and our goals don't match perfectly. So I've always been fascinated by how people handle that. So wow. I started off studying the more subtle ways that people handle anger and aggression. So got interested in what I call social aggression, hurting other people by hurting their social relationships. Mm-hmm. So, you know, malicious gossip, relationship manipulation, social exclusion. Wow. The earliest term for that was indirect aggression. A newer term was relational aggression. They're all related constructs. Sure. So I got really interested in that and studied that and got my first grants from the National Institute of Health. And then I was fortunate to get funds for, you know, a big 5-year R01 to do a longitudinal study of essentially, you know, why some kids are mean and why some kids are not, trying to understand predictors of social and physical aggression and then outcomes of those behaviors. And we started with 9-year-olds and the plan was to follow them, you know, until they were 14. Yeah. And as they got older, this was about 2006, they started coming into the lab for these videotaped sessions with a best friend and with a parent clutching their cell phones, desperate to text.
Right.
And the parents were like, stop it, you know, put that phone away. And meanwhile, they were getting harder to schedule because mm-hmm. it was harder to get them to come into the lab. They were getting busier. And I went to a tech fair on a whim. Somebody stopped by my office at UT Dallas and said, hey, I'm going over to the tech fair. I'm like, okay. So I go over there and there's a table with a woman selling blackberries. Mm. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm a working mom. You know, I'm in the parking lot at the dance school or the soccer sidelines. I could read my email on this. I could carry this with me and read my email. So I got my own personal BlackBerry. And then I realized I was holding my entire social network in my hand. And so I called back the woman who sold me that device 2 weeks later. I said, hey, can you give me an estimate for what it would be? I want like 300 of these to give to these kids in this longitudinal study. And I want them set up so that the communication that the kids do gets pointed to some server where I can save it and code it and study it. And she's like, that's not legal and we don't have the technology. And I'm like, oh no, there has to be a way. And we'd get everybody's permission. I'm like, oh, don't worry. Yeah, we'd go through the IRB. We get everybody's permission. And she's like, I don't think we can do that, but let me make some calls. She hooked me up with a Sprint higher education software solutions engineer who knew that the federal government had just passed laws that financial corporations had to archive and monitor the text messaging of their employees to ensure compliance with federal law. And so this man connected me with 4 different vendors to piece together the technology. And we did a pilot study in 2006 where we gave kids devices that were configured to point their digital communication. At that point, it was email and instant messenger. And the students working with me said, you have to capture texting. And I'm like, that's silly. That's all LOL and JK. Why would I do that? They're like, no, you got to do texting. So we threw in texting and we gave these to 20 kids. And I remember the first night I could log in and see. And I got on, like in my home study, I got on and late at night and I started seeing what they were saying. I'm like, oh my gosh, wow. This is a window into the world of adolescent peer relations.
Yeah.
So we got funding to give those Blackberries to those same kids who'd been in that longitudinal study right before they started high school. So they had Blackberries, which luckily for me, the iPhone did not come out until their senior year.
Yeah.
Because iPhone technology doesn't let you do that. But in the day that I did the study, the Blackberries were still cool. So we got money. We had to replace about 150 a year because the kids would jump into the pool with them. So the technology on this, and I was so fortunate to work with great partners.
Wow.
And I know I love technology, but I don't understand the fine points. And anybody who knows me just laughs that I did this study because they're like, well, you're hooked on your own device. So of course you're doing this with kids. But they loved it because we gave them a BlackBerry and we got a new one every year, a paid phone plan. They got voice minutes, unlimited texting. And everybody knew that we were archiving and studying. But of course, the volume of it was just immense, like just unbelievably huge amounts of information pouring into this archive. So we've only coded samples of it. So bottom line, I'm interested in relationships. I'm interested in how people handle it when they're upset. I'm interested in subtle forms of anger and aggression. And all that led me to study text messaging and social media. So we got really lucky. The federal government soon after passed laws that financial corporations had to monitor all the messaging on social media. Mm-hmm. And so apps grew up to do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. You were just at the perfect intersection too. But to have that idea, to think about this is a technology that this population is using, we need to get on that.
But
that
they
is
showed
very
me.
Visionary.
The kids showed me. I mean, the kids, like, the since I was bringing them in and they were so desperate about these phones, like they showed me that. And then I went and got my own and I realized this is it. This is why they love it.
Yeah.
And they were busy. We still brought them into the lab every year and we got information from them and their friends and their teachers and their families. We got all kinds of stuff on them in real life that we could relate to what was going on, what they were doing. And I mean, there's a big, intense debate right now. There's kind of a moral panic over social media. And I absolutely think there are harmful things that happen. And I don't think any young person or any grown person ought to spend all day on their phone. But what I saw from what adolescents actually did and said, 70% of what they say is positive. They show incredible leadership on these platforms. The quality of interpersonal support that young people are offering each other via text messaging, when you read what they actually say, it makes you feel so good. And a lot of the big claims about how all of this is so devastatingly harmful are based on huge samples, correlational studies. There's a recent debate between Jonathan Haidt, who wrote a book, I think, called Social Anxieties, and Candace Odgers, who's a longtime researcher who also captures content. And I agree with Candace. Mm-hmm. There's a lot positive that goes on, and I think the negative effects have been overstated. But I've been more on the sidelines of that since 2015 because I moved into these roles, which I have no regrets about. I absolutely love my research life and still, you know, hope to write some kind of think pieces or whatever. But I've since the pandemic, I've been fully focused on academic leadership, and happily so.
I want to ask you some advice, if I may. Mm-hmm. You've been extraordinarily successful. And so I want to ask you for advice for students, for early career investigators. And I'm thinking particularly here about young women. Mm-hmm. Talk about advice and from your perspective. You had this long and successful career, and we hope it's much longer and more successful, of course. Mm-hmm. Kind of advice you might give to an undergraduate student and then maybe to a, you know, a postdoc early career investigator in terms of things to think about as you move forward as a student, a scholar, based on your experiences.
Oh, there's so much I could say. I mean, as far as women in science, I was so blessed to have two parents who thought I could do anything, you know, and my father was a professor of geology and was feminist ahead of his time and really made me believe that I could be anything or do anything and that my ideas were valuable. And, you know, that was huge. I think it's really important to have faith in your own ideas and to do what you think is right and study what you deeply care about. Mm-hmm. And so I remember my husband has wonderful friends, you know, who are, he's an attorney and she's an MD. And I got to know them. I met my husband on the first day of graduate school. We've been together ever since, but I got to know his friends. And I remember Lisa, who's a pediatrician, saying, I always thought like I had to be a doctor or a lawyer or an MBA. Like, how did you ever think to study this? And it's like, I did what was most interesting to me. My undergraduate mentor, Jonathan Cheek, has a son who's a psychologist now. And he was hired as an assistant professor at Purdue when I was dean, and I stayed completely out of it, you know. And he's, but I had a chance to do, you know, a dean's interview with him, and then I kept in touch with him his first year. I left at the end of his first year, but I had lunch with him, and he said, like, how do you get from assistant professor at Reed College to a dean at Purdue? Like, how'd that happen? You know, and he's the son of my mentor who's known me my whole, you know, a lot of my life. And I said, I just always moved toward what seemed most important and interesting and compelling for me to do. It's hard to trust your own ideas. It's hard to look at a field and think, how will I ever contribute? But think about, like, look around the world and think about what really matters to you and study that. And don't feel like you have to get pulled around by fads, you know, because I remember people telling me, you'll never get a grant dollar if you don't have physiological measures. And I think it's wonderful to measure physiology in relation to everything else, but I have never had a physiological measure in any study I've ever conducted, not a single one. And I got funding. You know, I had a lot of years of continuous funding, and my work was always rated high on innovation. I think, too, it's important to try to be as clear as you can and to explain your ideas clearly. And so early on, I got an RO3, what they call a small grant, but it's significant funding. That was my first grant. And then I got, back in the day, what was called a first award. So that was a 5-year award for new investigators. And so every grant I ever wrote was ultimately funded, on the first time. Yes. But, I mean, there was a lot of revision. Yeah. So I had some early success, and friends of mine were struggling to write grants. And I would say, oh, well, you want to see my example? I'll show you. Like, I don't think it's perfect or anything, but you want to just see? Mm-hmm. And the feedback always was, but what you proposed was so simple. But I explained it really clearly. Yeah. So, you know, I think study what you care about and try to explain it really clearly. And, you know, move to the things that you enjoy. So as an assistant professor, you know, they tried to spare me administrative work, but I was interested in things. So they let me be part of designing a new building at Reed College. And I loved that. And I learned so much about buildings. Like, that was really cool. So I liked projects. So when people would ask me to do projects, I would do them if they were interesting to me.
Sure.
And I did some really interesting projects along the way. But I think young people need to be careful about deploying their energy, because if you're good at things, you'll get all kinds of, you get asked to do everything under the sun and collaborate with everybody. So I think we have to be clear about what we're most interested in. And I was far along. I was an associate editor of a journal, Merrill Palmer Quarterly, a very good developmental journal. And the journal had a wonderful editor-in-chief. And I got this manuscript, and it was good, but I didn't really like it. And it was all about developing a measure. And, you know, so I kind of consulted with the editor-in-chief. I'm like, I don't really. And he's like, oh, that's not within our mission. I'm like, the journal has a mission? Show me the mission. You know? So the journal had this long mission statement that somehow I had never managed to see. And it said that measure development papers weren't within the mission. So this was this big epiphany for me. Yeah. Like, a mission. The journal has a mission. And if it's not in the mission, I'm like, I need a mission. Mm-hmm. What's my mission? And I'd always kind of, you know, had a sense of that, but it was this, like, I need a mission. I need to be really clear about, you know, what I'm trying to do. So that was helpful. So I think as much as possible, we need to start every day, every week, every month, thinking like, what are we really trying to do this month? And that's different than your calendar. It's different than your email. It's thinking like, what am I trying to do here? Of course, you have to answer the email and you have to go to all the appointments. But if you know what you're trying to do, all of those things become opportunities. So all these meetings I've been doing, you know, all these, like, I have very early emerging things that I hope that we can do together here at CSU. And all of those meetings are chances to start to hear what people are interested in, say a little bit about what I might like to do, refine the, you know, it's all about collaboration. But I think any woman in science, any person just needs to try to be as clear as possible about what your main goals are.
This is such great advice. I want to cast our vision to the future for just a moment. One of many things I love about Dean Youngblade is when our executive committee meets and we're visioning, Lisa has a way of asking these what if questions. Mm-hmm. What if we imagined a different way to do X or Y or Z? What if we built this? What if we stopped, you know, doing something? So as you cast your imagination over the coming 5 years or so, what are some sort of what ifs that you might posit for us?
So what if we fully understood the power of artificial intelligence to focus our academic endeavors on the pieces that only we can do? Mm-hmm. So what if we could understand and use artificial intelligence to free us up to, as teachers, as professors, to have even more time to make personal relationships with students? Mm-hmm. What if we could envision the role of AI in the research we do? Mm-hmm. What if we could understand fully and deeply that our students will move into a world powered by AI, teach them to use it and appreciate it, and teach them skills that only they can add? Because mm-hmm. there will never be a replacement for a human nurse at a bedside,
right,
or a human face mm-hmm. in a restaurant when you go to a hotel, or a human being when you're building a building, mm-hmm. or an early childhood educator. AI will never ever educate preschool children,
right?
You know,
right.
And maybe it can do some cool things with K through 12, but yeah. But we need to fully embrace it and understand it as a university. And to me, it's so much about hope and promise. I mean, I understand everybody's worried about it. I understand, oh, our students are going to cheat with ChatGPT. Well, let's build it in. Let's have them do assignments with
exactly.
ChatGPT. Let's force ourselves to experiment with it. Mm-hmm. I think there's incredible opportunity there.
I agree.
So that's my big what if.
I love it.
Yes.
I love it.
I'm ready for it.
And the human piece will matter more than ever. I mean, yes. Nothing about AI will ever take away from a College of Health and Human Sciences or a university led by human faculty and staff. Like that, AI can help us, I think, spend more of our time on the personal, the uniquely human, the piece that only we can do.
Right.
Well said. My yeah. gosh. Well, thank you so much for a few minutes of your time. This has
thank
been just
you.
Delightful.
Incredible.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for your time.
Another great interview is in the books. Thank you for listening to this episode of Health and Human Science Matters.
If you want to hear more from Provost Underwood, find her interview on the Next 150 podcast, hosted by Colorado State University President Amy Parsons. If you haven't already, add Health and Human Science Matters to your library of podcasts. Give us a rating and leave a review. And if you want to learn more about our College of Health and Human Sciences at CSU, go to www.chhs.colostate.edu.